Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Jeanette Parker, representing, of course, Medical Whistleblower from Lawrence, Kansas. And we have a very special show for you tonight and some really wonderful guests. And we're going to be highlighting the importance of national security whistleblowers to our nation's security and also to the protection of human rights. Medical Whistleblower is a nonprofit agency here in Lawrence, Kansas, and we work with persons who report medical fraud, abuse, and neglect, and those who also report violations of human rights. We have a number of wonderful people with me today who will be helping us discuss this question. And I am going to probably let them each give you about a minute introduction of themselves. So we'll start here with former FBI agent Jane Turner. Jane, do you want to say a few moments?
Thank you, Dr. Janet. It's a pleasure to be on this program with you. And my background was as an FBI agent for 25 years. And I blew the whistle on misconduct and malfeasance in Indian Country. And also on theft from Ground Zero by FBI agents, where they took artifacts and brought them back to their field offices. My case started in, or where I got involved in whistleblowing, started back in 1998, believe it or not, and is still ongoing as we're waiting for the final disposition of my matter back at DOJ. In Washington, D.C., the Department of Justice. So that's kind of a capsule of my background and where I'm at right now.
Well, thank you very much for joining me. We're very privileged to have you on our show. I'd like to move on to Douglas Dodds. Douglas, you want to give us a little capsule of your involvement with Medical Whistleblower?
Yeah, we met some time ago, Dr. Parker, and it was a very pleasant meeting. I was introduced by Dr. Stagenborg to you primarily because of the work I do with veterans coming home from Afghanistan, Iraq, and also Vietnam veterans who have severe PTSD. We have formed several different types of groups that support veterans and give them an opportunity to socialize. But especially we're now involved in a pilot project to create smaller groups, but groups that can go out into the community throughout the state and give more one-on-one counseling to veterans with PTSD.
And he is working on a very innovative project that I'm fully behind. I'm waiting to see it come to fruition for everyone. Can we move on now to Michael Driscoll? Mike?
Hi, Dr. Parker. Thank you for inviting me on. My background is I was a former Marine Corps officer, naval aviator, and I was an airline captain in Part 121 operations, and I reported wrongdoing in air carry operations, what we commonly call an Air 21 complaint, that was is being legally addressed before the administrative law judge in Washington, D.C., before federal judge Christine Kirby. And what they tried to do was run me off the company property with medical fraud, trying to tag me as being bipolar, and which was a total shock to me because in my military medical records, in my civilian medical records, up to the reporting event to the FAA approximately 7 years ago, I had none of this allegations in my medical records, and all naval aviators would normally screen for these type of serious disorders that would prohibit you from entering into naval aviation. These things are generally diagnosed early in adolescence and early 20s, and my wife's family comes from a very heavy medical background. Her father went to Tufts and Harvard, and is he's deceased now. He just passed away October 1st, but he was a 40-year veteran in medical affairs as an MD. He's board certified, and he was a colonel in the MASH unit in Vietnam as an Army doctor. and he was also a 30-year practitioner and taught at Michigan State Medical School. As his father had his doctorate from Harvard and taught at Harvard in biology, and my wife's mother's father was a surgeon. And they've known me since I was age 21. I'm age 55, and I've never had any of these things, and they absolutely refuted any of this allegation to basically run me off the company property, which is being addressed by counsel. But, again, I was shocked that it even exists, Dr. Parker, because from our family, it's beyond understanding that any ethical doctor would engage in this kind of activity because of the oath and the integrity, intellectual integrity that many doctors uphold. And quite frankly, I was shocked.
Well, many of us in the medical community were also equally shocked to find out that doctors forget their medical ethics and their obligations to human rights sometimes when they're pressured by employers or by government agencies. I'd like to move on to B.J. Davis. He can maybe enlighten us as to his interest in the national security whistleblowers.
Hi, good afternoon, Dr. Parker. It's a pleasure to be with everyone here on the radio show and our colleagues, whistleblowers. I'm a film and television producer, and my wife ventured into federal employment as a Customs and Border Protection officer while she was concurrently being processed in phase three hiring as an FBI special agent. She made a protected disclosure about a national security breach on July the 4th, 2004, at the San Ysidro Port of Entry, where 23 suspects from SIC countries, which are special interest countries, came in and were admitted into the United States, and there's no record of them as of today as to where they actually are in 2010. As a result of that, we actually, fiction became reality for us as we began living the life of enemy of the state, and where we, the government released all of its resources to silence Julia's very valid and protected disclosures as a vetted federal officer. And subsequently, we went through the complete serial series of misconduct as each other fellow whistleblower here has sustained and lived through to our horror and dismay. And as a result of us litigating the Department of Homeland Security, Julia prevailed in those proceedings, and which subsequently, because this is my field of expertise, having been become a whistleblower by second generation where my wife was attacked, we're doing a TV series about whistleblowers, the untold stories, and the judicial corruption as well. And I'm honored to be in this particular venue with you here today because I'm also recently elected the president of a Wounded and Distressed Warriors Foundation out of Georgia, which will be working with wounded warrior facilities and foundations across the country with Gary Sinise and Academy Award winner John Boyd. So it's a privilege and a pleasure, and I hope I can compliment all that's to be said here today.
And also, you might want to also mention that you have been in touch with those that we've been working with in Indian Affairs issues in regards to human rights also, have you not, BJ?
That's correct, Dr. Parker. I'm working with President Dr. Joe Shirley, president of the Navajo Nation. We're creating a Navajo global media network from the nation in the state of Arizona, where we're also prominent in the film industry as well. But we work domestically and internationally. And Dr. Shirley is the UN spokesperson for the indigenous people globally. So he has a great positioning, and he's also on the Homeland Security Council by President Obama. So all roads are crossing together as we are here today and to make a difference for all humanity globally around the world, and certainly for we whistleblowers who are truly America's unsung and untold heroes that dare to not only tell the truth but adhere to federal law. So take it back to you, Dr. Parker.
And I wanted to mention that our Navajo and Native American peoples, many of them have served in the military, and during World War II, those of us that know something about intelligence realize that the Navajo Indian language was used in signals intelligence to protect our nation's secrets at one point. So, you know, the Navajo people have a great heritage in protecting U.S. interests. So,
Absolutely. We actually were trying to get the surviving. There's like two co-talkers surviving that we hope to get to be recipients of honor because they, again, haven't been recognized in the contribution that they made. And by just coincidence, I happened to produce the Medal of Honor hosted by Burt Reynolds. So we're all on the same link there.
And realizing that the ability to keep the native language alive and in the people's minds and to teach the native language was a human right, which was oftentimes prevented for Native American people in the earlier parts of our nation's history. And so we want to recognize the wonderful preservation of the Navajo language and many Native American languages by the peoples of the indigenous tribes. Today we're going to be focusing on healthcare professionals and their duty to report human rights violations and healthcare professionals being required to be the defenders of human rights. And the problem that we often see with our whistleblowers is that one of the ways in which whistleblowers are silenced is to pull them into a hostile psychiatric evaluation, try to discredit them with some kind of psychiatric diagnosis, and remove them from their position of authority and their oftentimes their employment, and many times to pull licensing from them, whether that licensing be a pilot's license, whether that license be a security clearance, whether that license be a medical license. And this calls into discussion the dual responsibilities of a doctor. When you have a dual responsibility, which responsibility should take precedence? Those of us who work in areas where we are called upon to make decisions of an ethical nature in our work, we realize that dual responsibilities do come up quite frequently. And when there is a conflict of human rights are at stake, doctors are supposed to err on the side of protecting the patient's human rights. They're really not supposed, doing a forensic medical exam, to create a documentation that is contrary to the interests of the employee or the patient or the client that they are currently examining. And it's really required that they provide an accurate forensic medical examination, not one that's biased to the wishes of the employer. I wanted to talk a little bit to Jane here and ask her expertise because she has a special knowledge in psychology and in profiling, and she might potentially have had opportunity to think about these issues in regards to a profiling of a criminal suspect. Can you come in here?
Well, I thank you, Dr. Parker. I think it's interesting to note that my background, which was paid for by the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, was in forensic psychology, and I was a profiler, one of the original field profilers in the FBI. And when I reported on malfeasance and misconduct in Indian Country, I had some agents who were covering up sex abuse against Indian children, and they were covering them up as car accidents. And I would get a call from doctors asking why something wasn't being done when these kids were being anally penetrated. And so I brought this issue to my superiors, and when they did nothing, I took it even higher and back to Washington, D.C., because at that time I had been in for a long time and, in fact, had spoken nationally on how to interview sex offenders, how to recognize sex abuse in children. So I had assumed that I had the bona fides to speak on these issues. And what happened was the fact that they made me take a fitness for duty because they felt that obviously if I was, as I was told, I had a child of my own and I should be paying attention to that instead of to Indian children under my jurisdiction.
So clearly there was effort to silence you as a whistleblower, and they actually used a medical examination to do that.
A fitness for duty, which in the FBI is a death knell for your career because they take away your gun. It's highly embarrassing, and nobody wants to admit that they had to go back for a fitness for duty. In this case, the Bureau contracts with medical personnel in Chicago, and so agents are flown in from all across the United States into Chicago for fitness for duty. But the bottom line is very few show up because most will resign rather than face that. I, having a forensic psychology background, decided to take on the system because I felt I was strong enough of a personality and I had the educational background to do it. Besides, I had the truth and the documents. What happened was I did go to Chicago, and I was stunned to find out that they were no more interested in the truth than they just weren't interested in the truth. They had the write-ups given to them by the FBI that were very negative and accused me of ideas of grandiosity and I wasn't fit for duty. And, of course, I took the MMPI, I took all the testing, came out fine. And so they went ahead and wrote me up that I was not fit for duty because I had transitory, I think is how they put it, and was menopausal, which sounds dangerous to me, a menopausal woman with a gun, right?
Oh, yeah, so you're a woman, that's a real problem,
yeah.
Right?
Scary, with a gun.
Yeah,
so,
very dangerous,
me,
very dangerous. Well,
yeah, very dangerous.
I happen to know that these very hostile psychiatric evaluations are used very frequently against military whistleblowers.
Exactly,
and
they take away your security clearance, and your job is done. I'll bring it up real short to just give you an idea. I fought it, of course, had the knowledge to do that. It took a year, and we beat them back. It was totally removed from my record, which shows you it was totally invalid in the first place. The items that they utilized from the Bureau to write me up were turned out to be absolutely fraudulent and made up, and that was shown. And I appeared in court about a year and a half later, and one of the attorneys who thought that he knew about this fitness for duty wrote the Bureau and asked, he was for the defense, said, "I'd like to see the records on this FBI agent." And, of course, they came back that there was absolutely nothing in my background to deter me from testifying for the government. So they totally wiped it out of their system, acted like it never happened. And for me, that was a tremendous wake-up call. And I wish that I had pursued the FBI judiciously in a civil lawsuit, but I already have a whistleblowing retaliation and a Title VII going against them, which I have won. So that was just one I could not put on my plate, but I wish somebody would.
Well, we have many, many bones to pick with the government in terms of protecting our whistleblowers here. In regards to the effects of whistleblowing retaliation, can you speak to that a little bit, BJ?
Well, there's obviously a serial series of misconduct, which I'm sure Jane will agree, as we all can, that once you make the report, then you become the subject. You're targeted for all kinds of investigations to not remedy the issue at hand that you're obligated to reveal. And so you become targeted, discredited, slandered, and defamed, and that's to distract from the reality of the incident that you're reporting. So you have a moral, ethical, and legal obligation to report those things, and you become the bad guy instead of a hero. But it's very disturbing because the judicial process is even the administrative relief for whistleblowers, where your first route is usually the OSC, which has been fraught with corruption, even the recent removal of Scott Block, who was actually destroying cases that were submitted and filed to the Office of Special Counsel in D.C. So there are good people in the government. There are good people in the different agencies. But, however, there is this habitual unsaid word of retaliatory acts to suppress and hide and destroy the careers of those making those reports. So it's a mixed bag, and I'm sure we all have experienced that in different venues. Listening to Jane, I have a very close relationship with the FBI, having done the TV series, The FBI, The Untold Story, so I have a great affection for them. But I found, too, there was that, as she spoke of, that kind of internal corruption from the very top to the field agent, and then it's what we witnessed with Julia, that all that went from San Diego to Washington, D.C. So what Mike's experienced with the airlines, what you experienced in the medical field, Dr. Parker, I mean, it's all the element, the method of retaliatory abuse is the same, regardless of what field we're in, and it comes to that same ending. And whereas Julia and Jane were very few, there's only 2% of whistleblowers that prevail in proceedings, and that's disparaging because the system is not being allowed to function as it should. So turn it back to you, Dr. Parker.
Well, I'd like to get Mike in here to talk a little bit about how the removal of a pilot's license through a hostile workplace evaluation can take place, and why it's a death knell to a pilot's ability to speak the truth to power.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Parker. Yeah, I would like to comment on this, and everything that I've heard so far somewhat fits into my basic model of what happened to me. I was a senior MD-80 captain based out of Detroit Metro for Spirit Airlines, and what I was faced with at the workplace, I have a strong sense of ethics and a strong sense of doing the right thing legally as far as compliance of the FARs and Code of Federal Regulations. I had a top-secret clearance when I was in the Marines. I used to do combat evaluations of tactical Marine aircraft in the 3rd Marine Air Wing out of MAG 16 on the west coast of the United States in the 3rd MA. And there's 165 people behind my door, plus my 4 flight attendants and my co-pilot. So I have a very strong sense of ethics. What happened at work, there was a series of events that just kept on building and building. And the company culture wanted to go one direction. It appeared in total contradiction of federal law. I had a sim instructor show up on drugs who's now incarcerated in prison. I had a female, when I was a co-pilot, a female check airman, try to tell me to drop my pants in flight. I'm telling you the truth. I'm going to tell you exactly what happened. I had a company check airman who was removed, who told me not to write up the airplane and to bring it into maintenance bays, which is against federal law. I had an ALPA captain's rep and a company check airman pull me aside down in the Detroit ready room at Detroit Metro when I was a captain, line captain, getting ready for a trip, and I was asked about a captain upgrade. I heard if he was going to make captain, he's going to write up the airplane. And I told both of them that this is a serious violation of law, and in fact, this is racketeering. I says I won't be a party to this, and that's in the filing. I had a FAA inspector revise the procedure against the AFM, against the FAA order 8900.1, Chapter 32, Section 5 violation, and the word was he was getting paid off with a flight attendant hooker down at the company headquarters. And I walked into a Serpico the month before my check ride, and I knew the DC-9 MD-80 inside and out. And they took a limitation out, which is against the Code of Federal Regulations. You need a letter of deviation authority to do so. They didn't have one on file from the FAA. And this is the crux of the administrative law case before Federal Judge Christine Kirby. And I had no history of any of these allegations. And they sought to discredit me, Dr. Parker, with bipolar and delusional about what I was reporting. Well, the company had a 2-year window of long-term disability, and that was on the company's nickel. They knew they had a 2-year window either to destroy me medically so I couldn't return to work for another sim check and get me off the company property, which they did very effectively. I have to give them credit. They were very slick about it. And now the doctor that was involved in making these two separate allegations, he is not returning phone calls because he now knows it's been docketed before the federal judge, and he's he's running for cover, and we suspect Spirit Airlines possibly had put the bug in his ear to make sure he doesn't ever come back here. We don't know because he hasn't returned the phone calls, but it's going to come. We'll get into the next step of this legal address. We're addressing the Air 21 first. And when I quit after 2 years because I needed money to feed my family, they forced me to quit the airline because I was coming off of my 2-year long-term disability of pay, which is like 60% of my base salary, and I had to pay my mortgage and feed my family. I got a second opinion after this one doctor, Dr. Kabat, made these two separate allegations, medical allegations, and I told him, I'm getting a second opinion. My family's a medical family. I don't know why you're making this, these allegations, because there's no history of this. And he looked nervous, and I went to the University of Michigan hospital facility up there to the top guys in the Midwest, Dr. McGinnis and Michelle Heisehoon. And McGinnis is a top writer on bipolar disorders. So I went in there, one office visit with those two, in 1 3-hour session. They looked at each other and said, who told you you're bipolar? We write books on this. You're not bipolar, son. He goes, I need to talk to the doctor. I says, so I told him who made the allegation, and basically Dr. McGinnis with the Social Security Administrative Law Judge, because of all the stress was involved, basically ruled it was an adjustment disorder to an unfair workplace situation, because at that time, the legal filing before the Administrative Law Judge had not been filed. So they couldn't understand legally what was going on at Spirit because it was covered up. I had attempted to file an Air 21 case, but it was going nowhere because I was ruled disabled because of all the stresses at work and the corruption. So to make a long story short, I don't have these allegations. They covered up, at least they thought they did, the illegalities going on at Spirit Airlines. And meanwhile, they were seeking to destroy my medical license, so I couldn't even practice aviation at all. And I ended up in bankruptcy in Chapter 7. I had to file legally because I lost everything what they had done to me. So the legal filing that's now before the Administrative Law Judge, those medical records are part of the legal filing. And the FAA attorney that was assigned to Spirit Airlines called my attorney in a state of panic damn near, wondering if the doctors are going to be subpoenaed for the Year 21 case for retaliation, Dr. Parker. And he sent me an email. He said, I talked to your attorney, and the medical records are not going to be part of the Year 21 case. And I sent him an email back saying, Mr. McKinley, I said, I made no such agreement, but Michael Sacchitella, my attorney, is a very, very old friend, and I'm going on his legal advice, and right now, from what we understand, what they've done at Spirit Airlines is illegal. But they sought to destroy my medical license so I could not return back to work. Dr. Parker, and that's a fact, and it was actually my opinion. I'm not a lawyer. To me, it's criminal. I believe it's racketeering. I honestly believe it is. But that in a nutshell, is what's happened to me, and I don't want to ever see anybody else fall victim to this scam. Because yeah, Dr. McGinnis...
Just to clarify for some of our listeners, the pilot needs to have not only a pilot's license, but also a medical certificate in order to be able to fly a plane. Those are two pieces of paper that every pilot must have on his person when he flies a plane. Some of our audience might not know that. I just want to
Right. And you get two separate certificates. One's the pilot certificate that Dr. Parker mentioned. And then you get a separate document called an FAA medical license you have to take as a captain every 6 months from an AME, a doctor, designated by the FAA to give FAA flight physicals. And you have to be deemed fit for duty and block 63. Any disqualifying medical conditions must be reported by federal law. So if some doctor in cahoots with the company, like Spirit Airlines or any other air carrier, decides to put a hit on you, whether it's wrong or whether it's a truthful diagnosis or a knowingly fraudulent diagnosis to destroy the medical certificate, it now compels you under the force of law to report something that may or may not even be true, which means when the flight surgeon in Oklahoma City reviews it and if he's going to issue it as a special issuance medical certificate only upon the whims of the FAA flight surgeon. He can deny you the medical license knowing that it could be fraudulent, and that's a fact. But anyhow, my medical record issue, as far as legalities go, has been addressed with Attorney Sacchitella, and right now I've been told to just hold off on pursuing a legal address to that matter until further word. So, Dr. Park, I suspect something's going on behind the scenes that I'm not aware of that's possibly connected to the Air 21 case.
Wow.
So.
Well, there are many issues here in regards to medical ethics, and I wanted to point out that we do have a World Medical Association, which convenes internationally to discuss the ethics that doctors in the medical profession should abide by. And the World Medical Association's Declaration of Tokyo states that there's a prohibition of any form of medical participation or medical presence in torture and ill treatment. Clearly, labeling a person who is not suffering with mental illness with a mental illness and then removing their license so that they cannot speak the truth to their industry about issues of passenger safety. I mean, I think that would be ill treatment for sure.
Absolutely.
The World Psychiatric Association, which had met in Hawaii and did a declaration in Hawaii, prohibits the misuse of psychiatric skills to violate the human rights of any individual or group. And that would include any group such as pilots in general or an individual pilot. And this is also true for Islamic medicine, because the International Conference on Islamic Medicine made a similar point in its Declaration of Kuwait, which bans doctors from allowing their special knowledge to be used, and I quote, to harm, destroy, or inflict damage on body, mind, or spirit, whatever the military or political reason. And I point out that there's a similar provisions in the nurses in the directive on nurses' role in the care of detainees and prisoners, and also nursing also falls under the World Medical Association's ethical concerns. I'd like to ask Douglas to join us here in discussing a little bit. Douglas and I have been talking quite a bit about the proper care for veterans who have experienced combat trauma, have come back, and who have PTSD. And it is not uncommon for them to be misdiagnosed, given medications that are not appropriate for their needs, and not given the kind of care they really need. So can you speak a little to that, Douglas?
Sure. I've gotten very involved over in Roseburg in Oregon. Roseburg has had for the last 5 years they've been a major player in rehabilitation for post-traumatic stress disorder for returning veterans. And I became involved. I had gone through that program myself several times and taken extensive therapy for my own PTSD, but really gone to work as far as trying to be an effective mechanism to help other veterans. I had applied for a position at the Roseburg VA that was open to me. I was kind of submarined by some of the administration there. They had a couple of administrators, one of whom, her husband worked in the, I believe it was a drug and alcohol program at the hospital. And he was pilfering drugs. They fired him or let him go, and he became the head of the, under his wife, which is nepotism, you know, he became the new head of a department that was responsible for hiring support technicians to work in the PTSD ward. Suddenly, my application for employment disappeared. I was horror-stricken to find out that now my application, which included all kinds of personal information and so forth, was just missing. Someone had phoned in, even though I had been recommended for the position by the head of the department, Scott Scampini, who's the psychologist there, who is now in Georgia, has moved to Georgia, but Scott had recommended me for the position. Someone called in and said that I had withdrawn my application. Anyway, to make a long story short, I continue to help veterans. I have been involved with Dr. Finney, who is one of the head psychologists at the hospital, who is now helping us with a pilot project we're involved in. One of the reasons we started this pilot was because the program itself has gone downhill over the last 4 years. It's a case of personality disorders are hinted at for veterans coming out of combat. Pharmaceutical therapy takes precedence over logotherapy, which is mindfulness and a better form of therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder.
But can I jump in a little bit here?
Yeah,
There has been an increasing overuse of pharmaceuticals because they generate money for a particular group of industries, pharmaceutical industries, and that sometimes even in deference to the needs of the pharmaceutical companies, our government has been pushing these products on our veterans, even though research has proven other forms of therapy are more effective, like cognitive behavioral therapy and EMDR and other therapies like that. And so I wanted to mention that this is the fundamental precept of modern medical ethics is that patients themselves are the best judge of their own interests, and mm-hmm. that health professionals should be giving precedence to a patient's wishes rather
Parker,
than the views of another person in authority. Go ahead.
Dr. Parker, if I may, it's Mike Driscoll. And this is something that just came up in the news recently. The Department of Justice just filed a lawsuit against the drug maker that makes Seroquel. And the reason they slammed them with a serious lawsuit, a fine, the manufacturer was going to the doctors to try to sell that drug for off-labeling use. And it was not approved by the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA, I believe, is the regulatory agency for that for the drug manufacturer, is it not? And and they got a serious fine because the doctors were trying to use that drug to keep applying it to some of their patients, and it was deemed to be unlawful what they were doing. And it's like, and in the name of the almighty dollar, you have this unethical drug manufacturer going with their sales reps to these doctors to try to prescribe these drugs because the insurance carrier, the third-party payee, picks up the tab, and it's a moneymaker. But what we have going on here is a drug pushing for profit that's not approved by the FDA, and they got slammed by the DOJ, Dr. Parker, and I think that's obscene to be engaged in that kind of activity.
Yeah.
Well, we had similar kinds of litigation. I'm very proud of our U.S. Attorney's Office in Pennsylvania for going after Eli Lilly on Zyprexa and getting them for millions of dollars of criminal fines for doing just that thing, the extra label use. And also for the Seroquel situation, it was brought to my attention one particular three-year-old child being given that drug, and her parents were cognitively disabled, and they were given this drug, and they found out that the drug kept the child quiet at night. So they just kept redosing her and redosing her and redosing her, and they actually killed her with the medication.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
And they weren't being supervised properly in applying the drug. And I really questioned the use of this drug in a three-year-old that's pre-verbal, you know.
We have another situation here in Roseburg at the hospital where they spent thousands and thousands of dollars building a special wing for the PTSD patients. And then no one has, in the last year and a half, been able to move into the unit because the administration is, they're not giving enough funding to the PTSD program. They don't have enough staff. They don't have enough nurses to actually man that facility. So they've thrown all of these PTSD patients in with the drug and alcohol patients in that wing. And
how's that going?
It's not going well. And you have more and more complaints from veterans who are being over-medicated with pharmaceutical therapy, if you want to call it that. And,
yeah, I have a question. Why is it that we're heading as a society to medicate instead of getting into more cognitive therapy and getting into the root causes of what's causing this and try to head it off that way? It's like, why do we push the drug thing so much here in our society? That's always concerned me. Is it all about profit?
It's about profit, and it's also about political might. Pharmaceutical industry does spend a lot of money on campaign financing. And they do get a lot of things passed through Congress to help them create the best environment for their profit margin.
Well,
and,
is it possible?
We could spend an entire program just on that. But I wanted to point out that health professionals are supposed to explain frankly the purpose of examination in any treatment they do. Consent that's obtained under duress is likely to be a breach in medical ethics, and certainly when you contain a person in a psychiatric board or you have control over them through their veterans benefits or whatever, there is possible coercion of consent. Mm-hmm. And the graver the implications of the procedure or the treatment to the patient, the greater the moral imperative to obtain the properly informed consent. And that's part of the Istanbul Protocol of the UN of 2004. So I want to point out that these are not just ethical concerns in regards to the individual medical doctor, but they are ethical concerns that I have over the entire system of medicine in the United States as to whether it is in compliance with international ethics, medical ethics.
The tendency is to give the veterans coming home instantly the first drug of choice is Zoloft, and then they go to other drugs like lorazepam and so on. I think it's more for the convenience of those who are housing them than anything else. But the veterans are on trazodone for sleep, horrible drug, and that's the standard of care.
Yeah, I Dr. Parker, I had a situation where Dr. McGinnis at the U of M confronted this Dr. Kabat that they knew that I had a two-year window of opportunity to either destroy my medical certificate or clear me to go back to Spirit Airlines to return to my flight duties. And Kabat chose the wrong path, let's just say that. And when Dr. McGinnis, and he's brilliant at the University of Michigan, I guess he's world-renowned, he called him up and he says, I need to speak to you. And then he got into a full, it's in my medical records, and it's in the case filing before the judge. He got into a full legal academic argument with this guy, and he says, why did you do what you did? Give me the scientific reasoning why you did. You know what it said in the report? He came back and he says, I don't have any reason why I did that. And Dr. McGinnis says, excuse me? It's in the report, Dr. Parker. And I gave it to Attorney Sacitella, and he says, look at this. He goes, so why did he do what he did? You know what? He's been caught. he's been caught by some third party. We suspect it's Spirit Airlines, but that's going to be addressed shortly. And if he's done that, that's medical misrepresentation. And I'm not a lawyer, Dr. Parker, but I would guess that that would be a felony to do something like that and put someone on medication when you knew full well he didn't have that disorder.
Well, doctors, even though they're appointed and paid by a third party, such as an employer, they still retain a clear duty of care to the patient whom they examine and treat. And the doctor is supposed to refuse to comply with any procedures that may harm the patient or leave them physically or psychologically vulnerable to harm. And that
right.
would certainly what you're describing would it be included in that. And doctors are under an obligation, medically, ethically under an obligation, and I would point out, I believe, legally under an obligation under the UN documents to ensure that their contractual terms of employment allow them to have professional independence to make appropriate, accurate clinical judgments. And that they're not supposed to prevent any person from having accurate medical examination and treatment.
Right. We have a situation right now. The FAA attorney that was assigned to Spirit Airlines, we don't know why he got into our private my private medical records out here just prior to the filing of the court case up in Washington, D.C., and that's part of the secondary legal address that Attorney Sacchitello will be getting into. But he has now he's broken in. He's gotten access. He's violated the Privacy Act of protected medical records. And two healthcare professionals that were associated with those medical records here in Massachusetts, Dr. Parker, have been dismissed by the facility. And I have asked them, did they do something illegal with my medical records? And they said, only under subpoena will tell you the answer. And I said, you know what? I said, the fact that you're telling me only under a subpoena is raising a major red flag with me. And why did you bring up that they were let go or discharged or asked to resign? If they haven't done anything wrong, why did you bring it up when I asked if I could speak to them? And it's, to me, it's just I know what's happened because I finally got those medical records here under a HIPAA law, and as me and my wife went through them, there were false statements throughout the report, and I called Sacchitello up immediately and notified him that there were false statements in these medical records. What do I do? He goes, just hang on to them. We'll get to that next. Something's happened, Dr. Parker.
If I can mention...
Jane, can we have you join us?
Yeah, if I can mention something real quick. When a whistleblower or an advocate for whistleblowers speaks truth to power, what usually happens is power is going to come down on you like a pile of bricks.
That's happened to me.
Oh, you betcha. It's happened to all of us. And the damage is just unbelievable. Whistleblowers have lost their families, their finances. But this is one of the problems is when you speak truth to power, power in a lot of times is going to come back and hurt you badly. And I think that's what a whistleblower has to accept at the end of the day is that you did the right thing. And that's what it costs. Now, what we're trying to do, all of us on this program, all of us with POGO, with the National Whistleblower Center, the people who are speaking right now are trying to put together this group that can speak for as more than just one individual. Because power can squish one individual with no problem. They've done it effectively. But hopefully if we can band together and we get supporters, because nobody grows up and wants to be a whistleblower. Nobody, whenever they were a kid and they said, what do you want to be? No one has ever said, I want to be a whistleblower. There just is no profit in it. There's no popularity in it or anything else. But if we could get supporters for whistleblowers, if we could get people who support us and who can provide us a platform to stand on, we'd be so much better off. And I guess what I would like to ask for is that people who are listening to this radio program, if you would support whistleblowers, if you support people on this program, that would mean so much, because oftentimes we are crying out in the wilderness.
Yeah, Jane, if I may say something, Mike Driscoll again, and this is a personal thing. I am a devout Christian. I'm Roman Catholic by birth, and I'm a devout. And what we do, we worship the truth. That's what we do.
Yes.
We worship
yes.
the truth. And I'm a devout Christian. I have had an epiphany, so to speak. I had an encounter when I got out of the Marine Corps when I was discouraged with things I saw under a top secret clearance. I did have an epiphany. I had an encounter with my wife. I was agnostic really at the time. I couldn't say yay or nay, but I did have a true epiphany. We had an encounter with the Holy Spirit at St. Paul's Church in Hingham, Massachusetts, and I had a true conversion that there is a Holy Spirit. And I ever since that was in 1984. I guess what I'm trying to say is what you were saying. I know it sounds, I don't want to sound trite or corny, but when you said, when truth confronts power, power comes back on that person who's telling the truth in a very serious and lethal way many times. And, you know, quite frankly, Jane, that sounds to me when Christ himself tried to confront those in power, if he was truth incarnate, what did they do to him?
Right.
I mean, I'm a Christian, and I don't wear it on my sleeve. I try to tell the truth all the time. And I found in my life many times it gets me into trouble with powers to be.
When I applied for that position and my records were stolen, I did file a complaint with the IG, who turned me down because they were in bed, I think, with the administration of the hospital, who had his hand caught in a mess.
Okay,
and so I went to the labor board, and I worked with them for several months. I had all my facts in order and so forth. And what it all came down to was at the very last end, they said I was a couple of days late in getting my paperwork into the labor board, and so they washed their hands of the whole thing.
Okay, if I may add, when you said you went to the IG because they were in bed, in my Air 21 case, they were fully informed of that procedure being illegal, and they were in bed with the FAA, and now they have serious issues that are getting resolved with the FAA Administrator Babbitt, because they know they've lied in the IG's report that was sent to me via Senate 11's office, and now it's going before a federal judge, and they have to rectify the false statements and all the inaccurate statements that the IG's report put out, because it's going before a federal judge. And they thought it would never see the light of day before a federal judge, because they saw to it that it would be deep sixed. And it didn't happen. Now they're in deep trouble. I'm talking the FAA and the IGDOT, Scott Harding's office. But as you said, in bed, yes, I got the feeling the IG's office was just rubber stamping the FAA's lies on my case, and now they're in deep trouble.
To interject here, because we only have 6 minutes remaining. We've all seen power exerted to silence our whistleblowers, and what I wanted to point out to our listeners today is that the use of power includes the use of these industry-employed physicians who are employed by businesses, insurance companies, and agencies for the purpose of conducting medical exams. And they have a clear conflict of interest with the interests of the patient, and oftentimes they are used to discredit our whistleblowers. So I want to thank everyone for listening to us today.
Thank you, Janet.
We clearly have a great deal more to discuss, and we don't have enough time on this program to cover everything. I could spend an entire program on each of your stories. I thank you very much for joining me. This is Dr. Jeanette Parker. I am a medical whistleblower. I am an advocate for those who, in the medical and health fields, come forward and report patient abuse, patient neglect, medical fraud, and human rights violations. And as we've heard today, that human rights violations can be a part of what happens to whistleblowers in our national security services, whether they be in the military, whether they be in the FBI, whether they be in U.S. Customs. All of these groups have whistleblowers who need their human rights protected. And I would also like to point out that many of our whistleblowers are acting in an effort to protect the rights of the public or a particular group. I know Jane Turner was working to protect the rights of Native American women and children. I know that Doug has been working to protect the rights of veterans, their human rights. I know Michael Driscoll has been working to protect the rights, the human rights of passengers on the plane that he would be flying, as all pilots are the defenders of human rights of passengers and crew on their planes. And
Amen.
so each of you are yourselves a human rights defender, and thus would be a person I would advocate for at the level of the United Nations. And I thank you all for your trust in and allowing me to advocate for you and to bring forward some of your issues. I wanted to point out that we have legislation currently in front of the U.S. Congress in regards to whistleblower reform. Whistleblower reform is very protection is very much needed. There are many things that still need to be changed, and even the bill that's currently in front of the U.S. Congress, hoping that we will eventually see legislation that truly protects the rights of all of our defenders of human rights. And each of us, as we step forward to tell truth to power, we are telling the story of the needs and the human rights of other people. And therefore, we are human rights defenders, as it is indicated in the Declaration of Human Rights Defenders, which is in the UN Charter. So I would like to, it's associated with the UN Charter Declaration. So I want to thank you all for being with me today.
Thank you,
this,
Dr.
again, is
Parker.
Medical Whistleblower. I come to you live from Lawrence, Kansas. You can see our website at medicalwhistleblower.viviti.com. And you can also participate on our petition website at change.org/medicalwhistleblower. And we do have some petitions up on that website in regards to the protection of whistleblowers. And I do have one new caller called in, so I'm going to see who that is right now. We only have a few minutes left. Hello? Hello?
Connected.
Hello? Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Dr. Parker, this is BJ Davis. I was cut off. I lost the connection.
Oh, okay. BJ, do
you
want to give a little spiel for our last 2 minutes remaining?
Well, just very quickly, just to kind of sum things up, I was cut off when Jane was discussing things at greater length there, and I raced to get another telephone. You know, what's happened to Michael, the medical records, even, you know, in the course of litigation, the Screen Actors Guild gave up our medical records without a subpoena to Homeland Security, and in the course of us deposing them, they were able to depose us. They hired a doctor to do an impromptu psychiatric examination of us. They paid this doctor $20,000, which we found out in discovery in the course of the litigation. And he, of course, cited, you know, the government side in their defense, which the attorneys of record were, you know, U.S. attorneys being paid at taxpayers' expense. So this is the cycle, which I think we all agree on, that goes on in retaliation against the American heroes making those disclosures. So
thank you, BJ. We've got only
you.
A few seconds left, and so thank you for your wrap-up. Thank you all for being with me. I appreciate you. I hope you will come on my show again.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Dr. Parker.
Thank you.
All right, night.